Chapter 14. Nothing in an airship was ever enacted without an extreme surfeit of caution. This maxim was especially applicable to a hydrogen-filled airship sailing beneath a sky of rock, above a bottomless sea of black, miles beneath the natural surface of the Earth, far from the least possibility of assistance. We advanced with the utmost trepidation, traversing the distance to our edifice at scarcely more than a walking pace. The throb of our engines rattled back at us from the ceiling, creating a horrible, echoing resonance. If there were ghosts down here, then surely we had roused them by now. But we had come to explore, and so we crept on, nervous intruders in the house of the dead, yet galvanized by the work of science. Each foot gained closer to that object was a victory for the intellect over base superstition, and slowly, as our searchlights groped across the abyss and began to daub more light on the object, our collective will was rewarded. It was hard to describe, because what we could see of its form owed nothing to familiar experience. It did not really resemble any citadel, even an inverted one, except perhaps some mad Babel conjured up by the likes of Bosch. It did not have the form of a barnacle or a stalactite, nor was it much like a chandelier or a half-emerged maggot. But it had emerged, or was in the process of emerging, or was in some fashion half in and half out of the ceiling, such that only a portion of it extended into the void. How much was up there, entombed in rock, we could but guess. But the visible portion was far larger than Demeter, extending a quarter of a mile down from the ceiling and about the same distance across at its widest point. In our searchlights, it had two kinds of surface, arranged in distinct areas. One had a smooth, grey, tin-like luster and a faint patterning of scales. The other kind was a sort of bristling cityscape of close-set towers and spires, projecting out like defensive spines. These areas interchanged across the entire object, hinting at some rationale, some organizational principle that yet eluded us. Its shape was impossible to convey except in the broadest generalities. It looked a little like a fat-bladed propeller, a little like a coiled python, a little like a piece of candy that had been twisted and retwisted until all notion of its prior form was lost. Its projections, lobes, and concavities were either smooth or spined, but never an amalgam of the two. We commenced a slow encirclement of the object. Miss Cossiel exposed herself to risk while exposing more reels of film, and Dupin went into a fit of sketching, muttering, sketching, tearing out sheets and muttering again. He drew as furiously and precisely as ever, but something about the form defeated his efforts, as if the object itself were not just presenting a changing aspect to us, but also oozing slowly from one deceptive configuration to another. Eventually, this endeavour proved too exhausting even for Dupin, and he wilted into a sort of gibbering seizure, whereupon I ordered him confined to his bed for an indefinite interval. I was not concerned with who he imagined was driving him to this madness, but I had a duty of care.
"There's something about those surfaces,"
he told me, as I almost forced him upon his bunk. His skin glistened, pajamas already sodden with sweat.
"I think they are shadows of a prior form, relics of an earlier configuration. If one was in and one was out, I wish I had my books."
I touched a hand to his brow. It was a furnace. "Try and rest," I advised.
"I want to rest, but I can't. It's too important for that."
"Nothing is more important," I urged.
"They need my mind."
"Whoever they are, Raymond, you will pay them no further heed." I raised my voice as far as I dared. "I am your doctor, and this is an end to it." A fever sweeping through Demeter was the last thing we needed, but so far Dupin seemed to be the only sufferer, and a persistent one at that. Whatever the cause of his complaint, besides overwork, I assured myself that it was internally generated.
"You don't understand what this means to me,"
Dupin said forlornly.
"You can't. No one could, unless they were me.
I know you want to solve your problem very badly. But if it were a choice between life and death, would it really matter so much? If you work yourself to fatal exhaustion finding the solution to this one riddle, there'll be no you to enjoy the glory that comes after.
But they'd still know what I'd done,
Dupin answered.
That would be enough for me. Enough for any mathematician.
He stared at me in growing incomprehension, as if I were the one in the grip of delusion.
Can't you see that?
I wish that I could, Raymond, I said as kindly as I could. Now, will you at least try to recover your energies?
I'll try,
he said, making it sound very much like a hollow promise. Since a hollow promise was better than none at all, and any more persuasion was likely to be futile, I decided that the best thing was to leave him alone, where perhaps the natural processes of exhaustion might give him some respite from his mental labours. He had to sleep eventually, and even if his dreams were full of numbers and curves, at least he would be resting some part of his mind. Dissatisfied with my efforts, yet wondering what more I could do, I was in the process of returning from his room when the other airship hove into view. The presence of another vessel was an entirely unexpected development. We were still completing our first encirclement, and until that moment the other airship had been entirely hidden from our sight. Something very close to panic then ensued. Their nerves already strained and their senses heightened by that first glimpse. The men sprang into motion, rocking the gondola as they raced to their stations and prepared for action. Quickly, though, it became apparent that we were in no immediate peril from a rival expedition. As more of the interloper came into view, we began to realize that it was a sort of wreck, incapable of movement and unlikely to offer any threat to Demeter. It was older and smaller than our own craft, with a strikingly pointed envelope, gaudy colouring, and a prodigious fish-like tail. It was pressed hard against one of the smooth surfaces of the edifice, jammed between that firm mass and the ceiling. Nothing seemed to hold it in place, no cables or ropes, so there must have been enough gas in its envelope to keep it pressed into place. That was a miracle, though, because the ship as a whole was horribly buckled, and its engines, struts, gondola, and so on, were mangled beyond any possibility of function. If it had not been for that ceiling, the ship would surely have foundered in higher airs, rupturing apart and falling down in pieces.
There's a name on her, Murgatroyd said, pressing his one eye to a pair of warship grey binoculars. Europa. Her name is Europa.
Van Voet said to Topolsky,
Refresh my memory, Master. What was the name of the expedition who supplied you with these photographic plates?
It's just the name, Topolsky said.
You never mentioned that the earlier craft came to grief.
Topolsky flung his arms wide.
You never asked, dear Captain.
You led us into the assumption that the other men made it back safely. This is what you wished us to think, and you never once challenged our misapprehension.
The captain turned to Coronel Ramos.
Do you have an opinion on this matter, sir? You seem to be a man of honor.
That is for others to say, Ramos answered. But I must say this much. I did not know about this other airship.
Then you have been misled as thoroughly as the rest of us.
Misled is a strong term, Topolsky spluttered.
Be glad I did not say what is really on my mind. The terms of our arrangement are now void, Master. I trust Coronel Ramos will offer no argument in this regard.
You are within your rights, the Mexican said.
Good. Murgatroyd, will you escort Master Topolsky to his cabin? Confine him there for the rest of the watch, as per the letter of our contract. If any party is said to have knowingly endangered the expedition or withheld information pertinent to the safety of Demeter and her crew, they are to be confined.
This is an outrage, Topolsky said.
It is what we agreed, Ramos replied. I will take him, Henry. He and I have much to talk about.
He has a gun, I said. Everyone looked at me, surprised at my outburst. If they were surprised, so was I.
What are you whittling on about, Colt?
Topolsky snarled. "He keeps a very small pistol about his person," I said, flustered and confused. "I saw it. He took it out and..." But I trailed off, because what I was about to assert was nonsensical. "He took it out and killed me." "Be careful, Coronel. If he is carrying a gun about himself on a ship filled with hydrogen, that is another strike against him," von Voot said. "One I am much less inclined to forgive." Ramos took Topolsky back to his cabin, but Murgatroyd followed, not out of any doubt as to the Mexican's honor, but to ensure he was not overwhelmed. I waited in the gondola, wondering if the lie about Europa would prove a sufficient pretext to have us returning back up the shaft into the same daylight of the outer world. But von Voot was talking quietly to his men, discussing various strategies for getting us nearer to both the edifice and the wreck. "We are not abandoning his cause," I ventured.
"His course can hang itself, Silas, but we are airmen."
He nodded to what remained of the other dirigible.
"They were also airmen. There is a brotherhood among us, and we will not leave their bodies in this godforsaken limbo."
Demeter was berthed against the ceiling. This was a complicated and fraught operation, but not one that the crew were unprepared for. Mortlock and his men went out onto the envelope with ladders, grapples, and drills, boring pitons into the rock above us. It took 12 hours to complete the work, during which there was always the risk of some chunk of rock or ice coming loose and spearing us. Other than a few pitter-patters of disturbed debris, though, the ceiling held its integrity. As well it should, I thought, considering the unthinkable mass of matter suspended above us, and then rather wishing I had not considered it. Once the basic task of securing Demeter was complete, the second and more problematic part of the exercise commenced. We had moored about 400 feet from Europa, which was as close as von Voot would take us given the uncertain nature of the edifice. It meant that the intervening distance had to be spanned in some manner. That, too, had been prepared for. With painstaking thoroughness and slowness, the men worked out from the envelope, anchoring pairs of smaller pitons into the ceiling at intervals of about 10 feet, from which a sort of rope bridge could be suspended. The bridge could only be extended a piece at a time, and the men setting the pitons had to work out beyond the last safe anchorage on cantilevered platforms, with only that awful void beneath them. These were airmen, though, and years of service had cultivated in them a cheery disregard for the facts of their elevation. They whistled while they worked, and sauntered back and forth along the flimsy wooden supports as if it were the firmest, widest highway ever constructed. I could only take so much of watching those men, waiting for the inevitable accident. So it was a matter of some relief when Ramos asked me if we might speak. I suggested he came to my cabin in a few minutes, and I was already there when he arrived. "Doubtless this is difficult for you," I said, encouraging him to take a seat and pouring a glass of scotch. "You placed your trust in him, but so did we all. I believe you handled the matter as well as any man in your position could have done."
"It is not the first time I have been required to look after a difficult client," Ramos said, taking the glass. "Coincidentally, the other man was also a Russian, although from a very different background to our sponsor."
He had alluded to this incident once or twice, and I knew better than to press him on the details. I knew only that the man in question had been a political emigre, forced to flee to Mexico after the recent upheavals in his mother country, and that he had been assassinated while under Ramos's supposed protection. "If you want to know about difficult clients, ask a doctor," I confided. He rubbed at the healing skin of his radium burn.
"How is the boy?"
"Troubled, driven, possibly given to delusions of grand narcissism."
"Topolsky will not be in a position to ask too much of him now."
"True," I nodded. "But I'm not sure that will make much difference where Dupin is concerned. Something has got into him, and that fever is a strange part of it. If he has an infection, I can't trace the source of it. He doesn't seem contagious."
"That is one blessing."
I'd like to think that he'll rest, but I think we will need to be a long way from the edifice before that is possible. It exercises a powerful hold on him. We see a curious object, perhaps a voyager from another world, risen up from below or fallen from outer space. Either way, jammed in the crust like a plum in a pudding. But Dupin sees something else entirely. A puzzle needing to be solved. He frowned at my meaning.
Are we not also drawn to a puzzle?
But differently, I think. This is your expedition, not mine. The only reason I have ever left England is for employment, Ramos. I would have been very happy to be a provincial doctor if it paid. A house, a wife, a view of the sea. But not too close a view. That would have sufficed for me. I smiled self-deprecatingly. Curiosity is for other men. I came aboard to meet her because there was an urgent vacancy and the terms of hire were too good to turn down. And yet, I don't deny that there is an intriguing mystery here, and perhaps an important one. Now that I've seen it, I would like to know what the edifice is meant for, where it has come from, and who sent it. Those are basic human questions.
I share them as well.
But I am not sure Dupin does. I think his interest begins and ends in the solving of a particular puzzle, something to do with geometry. He sees in the edifice something which must be worked out, like a riddle or jigsaw, and his interest extends no further than that solution.
Are we different?
We are, I urged. If you saw two men in a desert playing chess, would you ask yourself, what is the end solution to this game? Or would you ask, who are these men? Why are they playing chess in a desert? Who sent them? Did they want to come here?
Dupin would not ask those questions, he agreed, nodding faintly. But the first question would drive him to the brink of madness if he could not see the answer.
I like the boy, I said. There is an honesty about him, and I've tried to be kind in response.
You have always been kind, Silas. But now I must trouble you with an odd question.
I nodded, remembering that it was he who had asked to speak. What is it? Ramos delved into a pocket and produced something. In his palm, it looked even more ridiculous and toy-like than it would have done in mine. A little pistol, I said.
A Derringer Model 95. Do not be fooled by its size. It is still perfectly capable of killing a man.
He eyed it with a certain distant regard.
Indeed, two men.
You found this on him?
Yes. I was quick about it and able to search him while Murgatroyd was momentarily distracted, searching for the key that would lock him into his cabin.
You have not told Henry?
Nor Van Voet. There is nothing in my contract that obliges me to. And I think Topolsky is in quite enough difficulty as it is.
He closed his fingers on the stubby little firearm.
The danger is neutralized. He might have additional cartridges, but I am confident this was the only pistol in his possession.
He nodded to the blackness beyond my cabin window.
I am going to dispose of it by the obvious means. Perhaps if there are troglodytic men below, they will find it a pleasing trinket from the gods.
You could have disposed of it on your way here, I observed.
I wished you to see it, so that we could both be certain of events.
Events?
You knew of this weapon, Silas. You correctly warned me that he was carrying it about his person.
I had no choice but to admit it. I did.
But how could you have known? It was well concealed. I have spent my life observing other men who may or may not be armed. I have become very good at spotting the signs of concealment, and still I did not know that he carried this pistol. True, a Derringer Model 95 is meant to be hard to detect, but still, you know.
He looked at me searchingly.
How could you have known?
I do not know, I said. And I fear that if I attempt to explain how I may have known, you will call upon the captain to relieve me of my duty.
Tell me, Silas.
I knew that he had a pistol because I remembered him using it. I watched his face, alert to the moment when he would surely betray his feelings. There was a beach, a rocky shoreline somewhere cold. Patagonia, I think. You were angry with him because you had learned something of his lies, just as we have done now.
That he had lied about Europa?
Yes, I affirmed, deciding that I might as well get it all off my chest. But it wasn't an airship. It was a steamer. Before that, there was an even older Europa, just a sailing ship. Then we were north of Bergen, and we weren't the same either. You were there, I was there, so were the others, but we were different men. I frowned, struggling to convey my impressions while not wanting to sound totally unhinged. Our names were the same, as well as aspects of our characters. You are always a man from Mexico, but the details of your life shift to suit the narrative.
The narrative, he echoed.
You will think I am confusing my own flights of fancy with reality.
I would.
Then, after a silence.
Except that I have also been troubled by these recollections of different places and ships.
I seized his sleeve as a drowning man seizes driftwood. Tell me, Coronel.
I do not think I am afflicted by them as badly as you.
He touched a finger to his chest.
I know who I am and what brought me here. But there are glimpses.
He breathed heavily, pausing before he committed himself to my madness.
I remember that shoreline. I see flashes of it. I do not know how, but I remember it. You were hurt and we faced annihilation together.
I let out a sigh of immense relief. If we are both losing our minds, then at least it is a delusion shared.
Is it just us?
I don't know. There is something about Ada Cassil and something about Dupin as well.
With that fever, any man would struggle to tell reality from fiction.
He would, I agreed. But there's also a remark he made about operating on you with a trepanation brace. I dismissed it. I wanted to dismiss it. But some horrible part of that chimes with my own recollections. I do remember a trepanation brace. It came in a beautiful box, French made. I can feel it between my fingers.
I do not remember that, he said. But I do have the impression I have owed my life to you more than once. That is,
he rubbed the radium burn again,
that this is only the latest manifestation of that debt. Something odd is happening to us, Silas.
Indeed. He looked around, searching for clues.
Could it be something in our water supply? A germ causing hallucinations? Some kind of experiment in psychology being run on the whole crew? Are they whispering to us in our sleep, making us believe these things to see how easily we snap?
I don't know. And who would they be, anyway?
I do not know how we can pursue these questions.
Nor I. But you have spoken to them all, and you probably know Topolsky as well as any of us. He seemed as surprised as anyone when I mentioned that pistol. Ramos dipped his head.
He did.
As if he thought his secret was still safe. As if he could not imagine the means by which any man could have known about that Derringer.
You do not think he has any recollection of these past episodes, even though he is in them?
No. And the same goes for Mortlock, and as far as I'm aware, Von Foot, Murgatroyd, Brooker, and all the other airmen. That is the strange part, if any part may be said to be stranger than another.
You and I figure in these episodes, and we are starting to retain some knowledge of them, however imperfectly. I shook my head in wonder at the craziness bubbling from my lips. If you had not become the friend you are, Coronel, I would not have the courage to speak my mind. I hope we are not humouring each other for the sake of avoiding offence.
No, he said somberly. It is real. But it would seem to affect us more than it does Topolsky or indeed most of the other men.
He lifted his eyes to mine.
You mention Miss Cosille. What is it about her that arouses your suspicions?
I smiled to myself and wondered if he detected a trace of my amusement. She arouses in me rather more than suspicion. She knows something. I cannot put my finger on it, but she stands apart from you, from me, even Dupin. It's as if we are the players and she is the actor-director, the producer, something like that. She is always there when I die, and each time she seems disappointed in me for having the temerity to die.
We all died on her shoreline.
I know. And then we all came back again, including her. His fingers caressed the derringer.
All the terms of our contract are suspended now. There will be nothing to prevent me questioning her if we felt she held the key.
I was surprised at his forthrightness, how easily he was willing to shift from protector to interrogator. Question Miss Cosille.
When the time is right,
Ramos said. From out in the night, we heard a scream that fell away to nothing. A man had slipped during the construction of the suspended walkway. One of the cockily confident airmen, he had not bothered securing himself to any of the pitons. His fellows had watched his fall, helpless as he dropped into the void, arms flailing, screaming until there was no more breath in his lungs. They had heard him screaming long after the point where they lost sight of his falling form. The men had listened and directed searchlights below, but there was no sound of him hitting anything and no trace of his body. It seemed probable that he was still falling. After that, there were no more accidents. Chapter 15. The engines were running again, to charge up the batteries that ran the electrical circuits and provided energy for the searchlights. In the galley, it was easy to think that we were still travelling, sailing under a starless night.
I have spoken to Master Topolsky, Captain von Fuchs said, taking in all of us present. He does not agree with his confinement, as is his right, but he has taken some consolation in my promise that we shall continue with the thrust of the expedition for the sake of the men who came before us.
Will you keep him locked up indefinitely? Asked Brooker.
That will depend on what we find in our airship, whether it magnifies or diminishes the scale of his lie.
Then to me.
The choice is yours, Silas, but if there are bodies inside that wreck and too many for us to bring back, it might be some comfort to their relatives to know that a post-mortem examination had been conducted.
The screaming of that falling man reverberated in my ears. I had looked out at the flimsy structure being strung across from Demeter and begun to calculate the excuses which might keep me from traversing it.
I will gladly attend, I said, but if anything can be said about the bodies, it may not be the sort of news that is welcomed. I am sure you will do your best, Doctor.
Von Voot glanced across the table.
You are in agreement, Herr Brooker? Insofar as the expeditionary party retains any legitimacy, you would seem to be its natural spokesperson in the absence of the Master.
Jawohl,
the industrialist agreed.
I would have hoped that Dr. Kurt would accompany us as a matter of course. It will hardly be a safe undertaking for any of us.
We will strive to take all precautions,
von Voot said.
You will have to take the minimum of medical supplies, I am afraid, Silas. The walkway is strong enough to take men, but only if they are spread out and not too heavily burdened.
Miss Corsile, your typewriter will need to wait on Demeter. That's all right, Cap.
She flicked out a pocket notebook and began to mime the jotting down of observations.
This girl came prepared like any good scout.
Then she gave me a nudge.
What about you, Doc? Shouldn't you be staying back here and working on what's really important?
There wouldn't be much call for me here. Other than Dupin needing rest, which I can do no more than recommend, the crew remains in excellent health.
Well, besides that poor dope who fell off the planks.
I forced a strained smile. A regrettable fatality, and one that I hope won't be repeated.
Actually, it wasn't your patience I was thinking of,
Miss Corsile persisted.
It's your pulp potboiler, Doc. I mean your novel, of course.
Of course.
Aren't we committing a grave injustice against the world of letters by tearing you away from your composition?
I am sure the world of letters will be quite indifferent either way, but thank you for your earnest concern for my, as you put it, pulp potboiler, Miss Corsile. How fares the work? Asked von Voot, with his usual polite but distant interest in my non-vocational activity, which he regarded as harmless but incomprehensible. Well enough, but I fear nothing that I write will be able to compare with the reality in which we find ourselves.
Surely your men of the Planetary Patrol won't allow themselves to be outdone by our modest adventures, asked Murgatroyd. They're off rocketing through space, not floating around inside the Earth. You can't leave us hanging, dear Doctor.
I'd say hanging is precisely what we're doing.
Maybe it's just me being ditzy, but I don't even remember where we got to, said Miss Corsile. Was the space dreadnought about to be overrun by the frog creatures, or were the frog creatures about to be annihilated by the space dreadnought?
You'd remember if you didn't keep making him change it, said Mortlock,
blushing as he sprang to my defence.
I don't mean any offence, miss, but if you'd just let him carry on with his yarn instead of picking holes all the time, he'd have finished by now.
I stiffened in the lightweight fabric-backed chair. It's all right, Mortlock. I don't mind Miss Corsile's criticisms. In fact, I welcome them. If she didn't have something to complain about, I would worry that I had inadvertently done something right. Miss Corsile nodded thoughtfully.
It's a doozy of a literary approach, that's for sure. Some folks might say that answering reasonable objections in advance would spare you a barrel load of scribbling down the road, but I guess that's for you to decide.
You are right, I said. And in that regard, I am afraid that the weight of criticism, entirely reasonable criticism indeed, forces me to beg an intermission. A collection of groans sounded around the table. Even Miss Corsile and von Voot joined in, although in the former's case I think it was more a case of disappointment at not being able to pick apart the latest installment.
Now you are being quite merciless, ja? Herr Brucker exclaimed. I desire to know what lies beyond the thermal barrier.
Well said, Fritzi, applauded Miss Corsile. We're all of us just itching to know what's on the other side of the thermal thingy.
I am set in my decision, I said, with heavy finality. Von Voot produced a contemplative rumble from somewhere deep in his throat.
That is settled, then. Before we adjourn, friends, perhaps a toast for the poor man who lost his life a few hours ago?
Indeed, I said, glad not to be the center of attention. Von Voot leaned into his senior officer.
What was the fellow's name again, dear friend?
By morning watch, the walkway had been extended across the entire 400 feet which separated us from the wreck of Europa. A telephone line had been reeled out along its length, facilitating communications across the gap. More importantly, the gangway had been tested, with groups of men going back and forth with heavier and heavier packs. Assurances were provided that it was now safe enough for the expeditionary party, or the rump which remained of that doughty cadre. The party consisted of Herr Brucker, Ramos, Miss Corsile, Murgatroyd, Mortlock, and myself. Topolsky remained locked up. Dupin had wanted to come, but I had insisted that the boy stay in bed, and for once I'd been listened to. Our equipment organized, we set off, climbing up through the envelope to the upper walkway, then onto the walkway itself. No part of that crossing was pleasant. A constant dread of falling chased me with every step we traversed, but it was completed without incident to any member of the party. For my own part, the blackness assisted. With an effort of will, I found I could pretend that it was a solid surface pressing in on us like a coal seam, rather than an absence of matter. 400 miles had felt less than those 400 feet, but once I completed it, I knew I could go back to Demeter, and that terror at least lost a fraction of its sting. That was not to say that the last part was easy. Europa was of a different design to Demeter, with a single gas-filled envelope, rather than a tubular envelope strung with individual lift cells. This precluded getting into her from above by any means except climbing down a chain of ladders that had been carried across the walkway and lashed to the outer fabric of her envelope. Although we were each of us roped securely as we descended the ladders, the illusion I had been able to force upon myself while crossing the ceiling was now thoroughly shattered. The last of the ladders was even on an overhang, so that my head extended out further than my feet. Regardless of the unknowns facing us inside the wreck, it was a relief to find myself in the relative shelter of her gondola, where there were at least screens of metal and wood to place the void at one remove. The gondola had buckled along its length, its windows had shattered outwards, and its control gear had been severed and tangled beyond any hope of repair. But there was no part of it that we could not reach, and after assuring ourselves, to the best of our confidence, that the fabric of the craft still had sufficient integrity to support our weight, we crept aboard with the light-footedness of cat burglars, not wanting to disturb so much as a grain of dust. We had not expected to find survivors, and there were none. Nor were their bodies to be found. Our first search was thorough enough, but on the second we searched every cupboard and locker, and the story was the same. Since the airship's crew could not possibly have crawled back across the ceiling and up the fissure without leaving evidence of their own ropes and attachments, only two possibilities remained. They had fallen into the void, perhaps preferring that to a slow, drawn-out death, or they were somewhere within the edifice. Levering open a box of supplies, Murgatroyd cast doubt on the first possibility. "We know from the berth that their crew numbered 6, which seems about right for an airship of this size." He dipped his hand through the cartons and tins still in the box. "These rations would have kept them going for many more weeks if they were careful. Condensed milk, coffee, chocolate, it nearly puts us to shame. There's potable water for ballast, too, and plenty of it."
"If they knew there was no escape," Brooker said, "would it matter to them that their rations were not yet exhausted? I think not. Their fate would have been the same, yeah?"
"Wouldn't matter to logical men, sir, but how many of us are ruthlessly logical? If these fellas thought they could hang on for a few days more, they'd have done so, right until the last drop."
Brooker shook his head, disappointed at such speculation.
"The Germanic mind would have accepted the cold facts. Better death with honor, yeah, than an undignified scramble for the last drop of sustenance."
"Good job we haven't all got Germanic minds, then," Murgatroyd said.
Before a second great war broke out among our party, I examined their other supplies, including their medicines. All the essentials were still present and in tolerably useful quantities. Some of it, indeed, could be ferried back to Demeter to augment my own stocks. It seemed a shame to let it go to waste.
"We must face the inevitable, then," I said. "If these men did not fall, and there is no reason for them all to have fallen, then they went into the edifice next to us. We ought not be surprised. It has drawn both our expeditions here, moths to the same flame."
"Not sure I fancy being a moth," Mortlock said.
"Let us see what traces they left after their departure," Brooker said.
locks, diaries, and so forth. And let us see what equipment we should expect to find on an expedition of this nature, but which is absent. That will tell us what they have taken with them, yeah?
Murgatroyd opened one of the cabinets we had already examined on our first sweep. Inside were six lightweight boxes, each about the size of a small trunk.
I saw these as we were going through, but didn't think to open them, he said, taking out one of the boxes and setting it down on a fold-out table. It feels empty to me, but we ought to check.
Model 13 high-altitude respiration apparatus, Brooker said, reading the printed label affixed to the box lid.
The container was indeed empty, as were the others.
I searched the other lockers, Murgatroyd said, and there's no sign of cold weather garments either. They'd have brought them for sure.
Then they left wearing that equipment, I said. The air in this void is thicker than the air at sea level, so there was no real need for respirators. But perhaps they were taking precautions for what they might encounter in the edifice. Who knows what foul airs might be trapped in that thing?
Ramos was drawn back to the empty box as if there was a clue in it that the rest of us had missed. He ran his fingers over the label, mouthing a word to himself.
Trece.
What is it? I asked softly.
Trece, Silas. 13.
In the same low tone, he added,
I feel as if I have been troubled by this before.
Some memory prickled against my consciousness. Trethe e Thinko, 13 and 5. You said that to me once. I frowned at the box. We have the 13, but where is the 5?
I cannot say, but I do know that this is not coincidence.
A voice interjected brightly.
Having fun, boys?
I could not say how long the reporter had been at my side, or how much of my exchange with Ramos she had overheard. I do not know if fun is quite the word I would choose, or that it is fitting in a place where brave men have perished.
We don't know what's happened to them just yet, do we, pal?
Nothing good, I venture.
Mystery of the abandoned airship. The Mare Celeste of our age, becalmed beneath the earth. Got a ring to it, don't you think?
While Murgatroyd, Mortlock, and Brooker were still searching the gondola's equipment stores, I took Miss Cossile by the wrist and pressed her forcefully against one of the ribs. Enough games, Ada, I hissed, while Ramos looked on impassively.
Oh, Silas, I'll be on first-name terms now.
She loosened her hand and made an exaggerated swooning gesture. This is a pretense, I said. This giddy cub reporter act. You know much more about Demeter and Europa than you're letting on. What is this? A test to see how much we can take before we crack.
Coronel,
she said, fluttering her eyelids in mock distress.
Have this man unhand me.
I will not. Ramos said. He is right to ask you what you know. Between us we have begun to see the light. You are part of something, and so is Dupin. So are we, unwittingly. We have been here before. Other Demeters, other Europas, in other places.
That radium jolt sure did a number on you, Coronel,
she said, shaking her head in sympathy.
And as for you, Silas, I'd cut down on those radium drinks you like so much. Keep glugging down that stuff. You'll be lucky to still have a jaw by Christmas.
I pressed her harder, leaning in until our faces were close enough to have kissed. I desired her even as she drove me to the brink of fury. She made me desperate. I wanted to treasure her and destroy her. I wanted her to share every secret with me through the confidences of a lover, even as I sought to extract those secrets through the vilest arts of interrogation. Doctors make very good interrogators.
Where are we? I said.
Where do you think we are? Aboard a ship called Europa, abandoned by her crew.
Is this the end, or just another dream along the way?
It's not the end, no.
Some coldness entered her eyes, the playful spark dimming. She was dropping one veil. The question was, did another veil lie beneath it?
But how far along you are, Silas, how near you are to accepting the facts of things, only you can say.
Only me?
Only you.
She ran a tongue along her lips.
The problem is, you won't face it. I've shown you the truth countless times, but we always end up back here. You find ways to kill yourself. You bend the flow of events so that you can regress back into yourself. A broken mast, a shot to the gut, a tidal wave, 100 other deaths.
And I? Asked Ramos, listening implacably.
You're a blameless passenger, dear Coronel. Swept along in his fantasy. Granted some agency within it, but unable to shape the larger narrative. Only he gets to decide if you live or die.
This is no answer.
You can't understand. Not at your present cognitive threshold. She looked at me. Silas can, but he won't. The truth is a raw nerve. Every time he touches it, he flinches back into this fantasy. I have to keep leading him out of it. It's like coaxing a puppy out from under a blanket. If I try too hard, and I have, he retreats.
I hope that she will make sense, Ramos lamented.
So did I.
There's a ship, Miss Cossiel said, after a heavy sigh. A spacecraft named Demeter. It was sent out on the heels of an earlier rival expedition, a ship named Europa. The two are etymologically linked, did you know? Demeter is sometimes seen as the epithetic surname of Europa.
Where are we? I pressed.
In Europa.
I said...
No, Dumbo. In Europa. The moon. Not the ship.
Oh, look, it's really quite simple.
That's not rock above us, it's ice. Layers and layers of ice floating over a lightless ocean. And we didn't come down into it via a Sims hole. We drilled and melted our way down through a pre-existing weak spot in the ice. Topolsky's fissure.
Topolsky is real? I demanded.
They're all real. Topolsky's the gazillionaire glory chaser who bankrolled this caboodle. The expedition's real. It's just the way it seems to you, this fiction.
I shook my head, denying her account, even as some part of it chimed with the truth. Why would I fight against this reality?
Because something very, very bad has happened to the expedition.
I looked around the abandoned, shattered gondola. To the Europa party?
To them as well.
As well?
This is the hard part, Silas, and for you, Coronel. Something awful happened to the Demeter party, too.
She nodded out through the walls to the edifice beyond.
Inside that thing.
We haven't even gone into it yet, I said.
Well, that's where it gets sticky, Silas. It's already happened. It is already happening. Everyone's already gone inside. The Demeter party is trapped and dying inside the edifice. An alien intelligence-gathering machine is sucking out their brains a little bit at a time. And unless you face up to reality, up to your responsibility to this expedition, none of them are getting out of there.
If she wished to explain herself, Ramos said, she would think of a better way than this.
Unless everything she's telling us is true, I replied.
It is, she affirmed. But there's no use in this. You think this is the first time I've laid things out for you? We're way past that. You just refuse to see.